Introduction. This chapter presents the skills you need to recognize and care for patients who are experiencing shock, are bleeding, or have soft tissue injuries. Because most soft tissue injuries result in bleeding, maintaining good standard precautions is important when you are caring for patients with these types of injuries. The chapter describes four types of soft tissue wounds: abrasions, lacerations, punctures, and avulsions. Techniques for controlling external bleeding are discussed, and you will learn the various techniques for dressing and bandaging wounds. Damage to internal soft tissues and organs can cause life-threatening conditions. Internal bleeding causes blood loss in the circulatory system and results in shock. Shock is a state of collapse of the cardiovascular system that results in inadequate delivery of blood to the organs. More trauma patients die from shock than from any other condition. Your ability to recognize the signs and symptoms of shock and to take simple measures to aid shock patients will give them the best chance for survival. This chapter explains the causes and types of shock using an analogy of a pump, pipes, and fluid. You will learn how the failure of any part of the system can cause shock. Burns are another type of soft tissue injury. Burns may be caused by heat, chemicals, or electricity. They may damage any part of the body and are especially harmful if they occur inside the respiratory tract. This chapter examines the extent, depth, and cause of burns. As you study this chapter, keep in mind the importance of maintaining standard precautions to prevent the spread of disease-carrying organisms. Patient assessment for bleeding, shock, and soft tissue injuries. It is important to follow the steps of the patient assessment sequence described in Chapter 9, Patient Assessment, when caring for patients who are bleeding, are in shock, or have soft tissue injuries. Your scene size-up needs to include all the steps you learned previously to ensure safety for you and your patient. When performing the primary assessment, you may need to temporarily halt the assessment if the patient is losing a significant amount of blood. However, once you have managed this problem, you should immediately return to completing the assessment sequence, performing all of the remaining steps to ensure no problems or injuries are overlooked. During your secondary assessment, be alert for any signs and symptoms of shock from internal or external blood loss. When obtaining a sample history, ask the patient whether he or she is using a blood thinner, which may interfere with blood clotting. When performing a reassessment, watch the patient for signs and symptoms of shock, such as pale skin, increasing pulse rate, or decreasing blood pressure. For trauma patients, you will usually perform the secondary assessment before you obtain the sample history. Review the patient assessment sequence. Standard precautions and soft tissue injuries. The concept of standard precautions assumes all body fluids are potentially infectious. Therefore, take appropriate measures to prevent contact with the patient's body fluids. Wear gloves to prevent contact with the patient's blood when caring for patients who have soft tissue injuries. At times, you may need to wear a surgical mask and eye protection if there is a danger of blood spatter from a massive wound, or if the patient is coughing or vomiting bloody material. Parts and function of the circulatory system. The three parts of the circulatory system are the pump, heart, the pipes, arteries, veins, and capillaries, and the fluid, blood cells, and other blood components. The pump. The heart functions as the human circulatory system's pump. The heart consists of four separate chambers. The two upper chambers on the top of the heart are called the left and right atria. A single chamber is called an atrium, and the two lower chambers on the bottom of the heart are called the left and right ventricles. The ventricles are the larger chambers and do most of the actual pumping. The atria are somewhat less muscular and serve as reservoirs for blood flowing into the heart from the body and the lungs. The pipes. The human body has three main types of blood vessels: arteries, capillaries, and veins. The arteries, big flow, heavy duty, high pressure pipes, carry blood away from the heart. The capillaries, distribution pipes, the smallest of the blood vessels, form a network that distributes blood to all parts of the body. The smallest capillaries are so narrow that blood cells have to flow through them single file. The veins return the blood from the capillaries to the heart, where it is pumped to the lungs. There, the blood gives off carbon dioxide and absorbs oxygen. The fluid. Fluid in the circulatory system consists of blood cells and other blood components, each with a specific function. The liquid part of the blood is known as plasma. Plasma serves as the transporting medium for the solid parts of the blood, which are the red blood cells, white blood cells, and platelets. Red blood cells carry oxygen and carbon dioxide. White blood cells have a search and destroy function. They consume bacteria and viruses to combat infections in the body. Platelets interact with each other and with other substances in the blood to form clots that help stop bleeding. Pulse. A pulse is the pressure wave generated by the pumping action of the heart. With each heartbeat, there is a surge of blood from the left ventricle as it contracts and pushes blood out into the main arteries of the body. When you are counting the number of pulsations per minute, what you are actually counting is each heartbeat per minute. In other words, the pulse rate reflects the heart rate. Usually, you can feel a patient's radial and carotid pulses. In a conscious patient, you can easily find the radial, wrist pulse at the base of the thumb. If the patient is unconscious, experiencing shock or both, it may be impossible for you to feel a radial pulse. Therefore, it is vital that you know how to locate the carotid neck pulse. If the patient appears to be in shock or is unconscious, attempt to locate the carotid pulse first. To locate the carotid pulse, place two fingers lightly on the larynx and slide the fingers off to one side until you feel a slight notch on the neck. You should be able to feel the carotid pulse at this location. Practice locating the carotid pulse of another person in a dark room. You should be able to locate the pulse within 3 seconds of touching the person's larynx. Shock. Shock is failure of the circulatory system. Circulatory failure has many possible causes, but the three primary causes are discussed here. Pump failure. Cardiogenic shock occurs if the heart cannot pump enough blood to supply the needs of the body. Pump failure can result if the heart has been weakened by a heart attack. Inadequate pumping of the heart can cause blood to back up in the vessels of the lungs, resulting in a condition known as congestive heart failure, CHF. Pipe failure. Pipe failure is caused by the expansion, dilation of the capillaries to as much as 3 or 4 times their normal size. This causes blood to pool in the capillaries instead of circulating throughout the system. When blood pools in the capillaries, the rest of the body, including the heart and other vital organs, is deprived of blood. Blood pressure falls and shock results. Blood pressure is the pressure of the circulating blood against the walls of the arteries. In shock caused by sudden expansion of the capillaries, blood pressure may drop so rapidly in your patient that you are unable to feel either a radial or a carotid pulse. The least serious type of shock caused by pipe failure is fainting. Fainting, a form of psychogenic shock, is the body's response to a major psychological or emotional stress. As the nervous system reacts, the capillaries suddenly expand to 3 or 4 times their normal size. Blood then pools in the dilated vessels, resulting in reduced blood supply to the brain. Fainting is a short-term condition that corrects itself once the patient is placed in a horizontal position. Anaphylactic shock is caused by an extreme allergic reaction to a foreign substance, such as venom from bee stings. See Chapter 11, Poisoning and Substance Abuse, Penicillin, or Certain Foods. Shock may develop very quickly following exposure. The patient may suddenly start to sneeze or itch, a rash or hives may appear, the face and tongue may swell very quickly, and a blue color may appear around the mouth. The patient appears flushed, red, and breathing may quickly become difficult with wheezing sounds coming from the chest. Blood pressure drops rapidly as the blood pools in the expanded capillaries. The pulse may be so weak that you cannot feel it. Pipe failure has occurred and death will result if prompt action to counteract the toxin is not taken. Spinal shock may occur in patients who have sustained a spinal cord injury. The injury to the spinal cord allows the capillaries to expand and blood pools below the level of the injury. The brain, heart, lungs, and other vital organs are deprived of blood, resulting in shock. Fluid loss. The third general type of shock is caused by fluid loss. Fluid loss caused by excessive bleeding, hemorrhage, is the most common cause of shock. Blood escapes from the normally closed circulatory system through an internal or external wound, and the system's total fluid level, blood volume, drops until the pump cannot operate efficiently. To compensate for fluid loss, the heart begins to pump faster to maintain pressure in the pipes. However, as the fluid continues to drain out, the pump eventually stops pumping altogether, resulting in cardiac arrest. External bleeding is not difficult to detect because you can see blood escaping from the circulatory system to the outside of the patient's body. With internal bleeding, blood escapes from the system, but usually the bleeding cannot be seen. However, you may see signs of internal blood loss, such as bruising, swelling, and rigidity in the affected area. If the patient is conscious, he or she may report severe pain in the immediate area. Even though the escaped blood remains inside the body, it cannot re-enter the circulatory system, and it is not available to be pumped by the heart. Whether the bleeding is external or internal, if it remains unchecked, the result will be shock, eventual pump failure, and death. An average adult has about 12 pints, 6 liters of blood circulating in the system. The loss of a single pint of blood will not produce shock in a healthy adult. In fact, one pipe, 0.5 liter per donor, is the amount that blood banks collect. However, the loss of 2 or more pints, 1 liter or more of blood, can produce shock. This amount of blood loss can result from such injuries as a fractured femur. Signs and symptoms of shock. Shock deprives the body of sufficient blood to function normally. As shock progresses, the body alters some of its functions in an attempt to maintain sufficient blood supply to its vital parts. Initially, the patient's breathing may be rapid and deep, but as shock progresses in severity, breathing becomes rapid and shallow. Changes in mental status may be the first signs of shock. Therefore, monitoring the overall mental status of a patient can help you detect shock. Any change in mental status may be significant. In severe cases of shock, the patient loses consciousness. If a trauma patient who has been quiet suddenly becomes agitated, restless, and vocal, you should suspect shock. If a trauma patient who has been loud, vocal, and aggressive becomes quiet, you should also suspect shock and begin treatment. If the patient has dark skin, you may not be able to use skin color changes to help you detect shock. Therefore, be especially alert for other signs of shock. The capillary refill test and the condition of the skin, cool and clammy, will help you recognize shock in patients who have dark skin. General treatment for shock. As an emergency medical responder, EMR, you can combat shock from any cause and keep it from getting worse by taking several simple but important steps. Remember that the protocols for use of these skills may vary. Always follow the protocols approved by your medical director. Position the patient correctly. If the patient has no head injury, extreme discomfort, or difficulty breathing, place the patient flat on his or her back, supine, on a horizontal surface. Place a blanket under the patient if available. Elevate the patient's legs according to local protocol. If the patient has a head injury, spine injury, or lower extremity injury, position the patient flat on his or her back. If the patient is having chest pain or difficulty breathing, which is likely to occur in cases of heart attack and emphysema, and no spinal injury is suspected, place the patient in a sitting or semi-reclining position. Maintain the patient's ABCs. Check the patient's airway, breathing, and circulation, ABCs, at least every 5 minutes. If necessary, open the airway, perform rescue breathing, or begin cardiopulmonary resuscitation, CPR. Treat the cause of shock if possible. Most patients who are in shock must be treated in the hospital with care provided by specially trained physicians. However, you are able to treat one common cause of shock, external bleeding. By controlling external bleeding with direct pressure, elevation, tourniquet, or pressure points, you can treat this cause of shock temporarily until the patient can be transported to an appropriate medical facility for more advanced treatment. Maintain the patient's body temperature. Attempt to keep the patient comfortably warm. A patient with cold, clammy skin should be covered. It is as important to place blankets under the patient to keep body heat from escaping into the ground as it is to cover the patient with blankets. Do not allow the patient to eat or drink. Even though a patient in shock is often very thirsty, do not give liquids by mouth. There are two reasons for this rule. 1. A patient in shock may be nauseated and eating or drinking may cause vomiting. 2. A patient in shock may need emergency surgery. Patients should not have anything in their stomachs before surgery. If you are working in an area where ambulance response time is more than 20 minutes, you may give patients a clean cloth or gauze pad that has been soaked in water to suck on. This relieves dryness of the mouth but does not quench thirst. No matter how thirsty patients are, do not permit them to drink anything. Assist with other treatments. When an advanced life support, ALS, unit arrives at the scene, be ready to assist them with further treatment. Patients may be given oxygen or IV solutions. If you are trained in the administration of oxygen and have it available, provide it to shock patients. Oxygen benefits shock patients by ensuring that the reduced number of red blood cells are as oxygen saturated as they can be. Advanced emergency medical technicians, AEMTs, or paramedics can administer intravenous IV fluids. Adding fluid to the body combats the loss of blood volume. Although rare, some emergency medical services EMS personnel sometimes use pneumatic anti-shock garments, PASGs, in the field to treat pelvic fractures. However, PASGs are no longer favored for shock treatment. PASGs are placed around the patient's legs and abdomen and inflated with air. As the PASG inflates, it exerts pressure around the legs and abdomen. Although, as an EMR, you will not use these devices yourself, you should know their purpose and function. It is also important to understand that PASGs must not be removed in the field. Removing PASGs must be done in a hospital and under the direct supervision of a physician. Arrange for transport. As soon as you determine that you have a patient who is in shock, make sure an ambulance has been dispatched. When the ambulance arrives, give EMS personnel a concise handoff report, emphasizing the signs and symptoms of shock that you noted. The EMS personnel will then ensure the patient is quickly prepared for prompt transport to an appropriate medical facility that can handle a patient with this type of condition. Usually, the most appropriate treatment for a patient in shock that is the result of injury or bleeding is surgical repair, and the sooner the patient gets to the hospital, the better the chance of his or her survival. Treatment for shock caused by pump failure. Patients experiencing pump failure may be confused, restless, anxious, or unconscious. Their pulse is usually rapid and weak, and their skin is cold and clammy, sweaty, and pale. Their respirations are often rapid and shallow. Pump failure is a serious condition. Your proper treatment and prompt transport by ambulance to an appropriate medical facility will give these patients their best chance for survival. Treatment for shock caused by pipe failure. Patients who have fainted, who are experiencing anaphylactic shock, or who have sustained a severe spinal cord injury will have pipe failure. Their capillaries may increase 3 or 4 times the normal size, causing signs and symptoms of shock. Treatment for anaphylactic shock. The initial treatment for anaphylactic shock is similar to the treatment for any other type of shock. Anaphylactic shock is an extreme emergency, and the patient must be transported as soon as possible. Paramedics, nurses, and physicians can administer medications that may reverse the allergic reaction. Some patients who have severe allergies may carry an epinephrine auto-injector. If the patient has a prescribed auto-injector, you can administer the epinephrine if you have been trained in its use and have permission from your local medical director. Be aware of and follow your local protocols. Support the patient's thigh and place the tip of the auto-injector lightly against the outer thigh. Using a quick motion, push the auto-injector firmly against the thigh and hold it in place for several seconds. This will inject the medication. The detailed steps for administering epinephrine by auto-injector are outlined in Chapter 11, Poisoning and Substance Abuse. Treatment for shock caused by fluid loss. Shock may be caused by internal blood loss, blood that escapes from damaged blood vessels and stays inside the body, or by external blood loss, blood that escapes from the body. Excessive bleeding is the most common cause of shock. Shock caused by internal blood loss. Patients can die quickly and quietly from internal bleeding following abdominal injuries that rupture the spleen, liver, or large blood vessels. You must be alert to detect the earliest signs and symptoms of internal bleeding and to begin treatment for shock. If you are treating several injured patients, those with internal bleeding should be transported first to the medical facility because immediate surgery may be needed. Chapter 19, Transport Operations, discusses how to decide which patients should receive care first. Bleeding from stomach ulcers, ruptured blood vessels, or tumors can cause internal bleeding and shock. This bleeding can be spontaneous, massive, and rapid, often leading to the loss of large quantities of blood by vomiting or bloody diarrhea. It is important to recognize the signs and symptoms of internal bleeding and take prompt corrective action. In addition to the classic signs of shock, confusion, rapid pulse, cold and clammy skin, and rapid breathing, patients with internal bleeding may show additional signs and symptoms as depicted in the signs and symptoms box on this page. Bleeding. Blood loss can occur through external bleeding, which is visible, or through internal bleeding, which can be hard to detect. It ranges from minor cuts to massive blood loss that can kill a person in a few minutes. As an EMR, it is important for you to be able to recognize the signs and symptoms of external bleeding and internal bleeding. It is also important for you to know what steps to take to control bleeding and what care you can administer for patients who are experiencing internal blood loss and shock. Controlling external blood loss. This section describes how to control external blood loss using direct pressure, elevation, tourniquets, and pressure points. Follow your local protocols for bleeding control. Some protocols may not permit the use of all these methods. They are all included because each technique may be beneficial to patients under certain circumstances. There are three types of external blood loss: capillary, venous, and arterial. The most common type of external blood loss is capillary bleeding. In capillary bleeding, the blood oozes out, such as from a cut finger. You can control capillary bleeding simply by applying direct pressure to the site. The next most common type of bleeding is venous bleeding. This type of bleeding has a steady flow. Bleeding from a large vein may be profuse and life-threatening. To control venous bleeding, apply direct pressure to the site for at least 5 minutes. The most serious type of bleeding is arterial bleeding. Arterial blood spurts or surges from the laceration or wound with each heartbeat. Blood pressure in arteries is higher than in capillaries or veins, and unchecked arterial bleeding can result in death from loss of blood in a short time. To control arterial bleeding, exert and maintain direct pressure on the site sufficient to stop the flow of blood until EMS arrives. If available and permitted under your local protocol, apply a tourniquet between the heart and the site of the arterial bleeding. Because many injured patients actually die from shock caused by blood loss, it is vitally important that you control external bleeding quickly. Direct pressure. Most external bleeding can be controlled by applying direct pressure to the wound. Place a dry, sterile dressing directly on the wound and apply pressure to the wound with your gloved hand. Wear the gloves from your EMR life support kit. If you do not have a sterile dressing or gauze bandage, use the cleanest cloth available. Wrap the dressing and wound snugly with a roller gauze bandage to maintain direct pressure on the wound. Do not remove a dressing after you have applied it. If the dressing becomes blood-soaked, place another dressing on top of the first and keep them both in place. Elevation. If direct pressure does not stop external bleeding from an extremity, elevate the injured arm or leg as you maintain direct pressure. Elevation, in conjunction with direct pressure, will usually stop severe bleeding. Tourniquets. Use tourniquets in any situation where extremity bleeding cannot be easily and immediately controlled by direct pressure or elevation. High-velocity gunshot wounds and explosive devices can sever arteries in the arm or the leg. These types of injuries result in rapid and profound blood loss that lead to death within minutes. These devastating types of wounds occur in military combat situations and in non-combat situations where high-velocity weapons are used by civilians or law enforcement personnel. Recent military experience in combat situations has resulted in some changes regarding the use of tourniquets. To reduce deaths from these types of wounds, the military has developed and adopted several modern versions of tourniquets that use simple laws of physics to apply sufficient pressure quickly and easily to stop life-threatening bleeding. These updated tourniquets can be applied in less than 1 minute. Because the tourniquets multiply the force you place on them, they require you to use only one hand to apply. Recent medical research indicates that a tourniquet can be applied and left in place for up to 2 hours without causing additional damage to the injured limb. This means that the use of tourniquets seems to have great benefit to the patient without incurring a high risk of further damage to the limb. Some EMS agencies teach their personnel the indications for the use of these tourniquets and how to apply them properly. You should use tourniquets once you have completed proper instruction and have protocols in place that have been approved by your medical director. Follow the steps to control bleeding with a tourniquet. 1. Apply direct pressure with a dry, sterile dressing. 2. Apply a pressure dressing. 3. Apply a tourniquet above the level of bleeding. Pressure points. Pressure points should be used for extremity wounds if direct pressure and elevation do not control the bleeding and only if you are not permitted to use a tourniquet or if a tourniquet is not available. Pressure points can be difficult to use to control hemorrhage and are not always effective. However, using pressure points to attempt to control bleeding requires no special equipment and should be considered in cases where other options are unavailable. For injuries too near to the body to allow for tourniquet application, for example, injuries that are too proximal or too close to the trunk to apply a tourniquet, junctional injuries, direct pressure and use of pressure points may be effective. Tourniquets, however, can be improvised when commercially produced options are not available. Options for improvisation include belts and articles of clothing tied around the limb as proximal as possible to the zone of injury. If you have a choice between using a pressure point or a tourniquet to control brisk bleeding in an extremity, use the tourniquet because it is more effective and will lessen the chance that the patient will die from serious hemorrhage. Pressure points may theoretically be able to control bleeding by preventing blood from flowing into a limb. This is accomplished by compressing a major artery against the bone at a specific location, a pressure point. Although there are several pressure points in the body, the brachial artery pressure point in the upper arm and the femoral artery pressure point in the groin are the most commonly described. When you are applying pressure to the brachial artery, remember the words slap, slide, and squeeze. 1. Position the patient's arm so the elbow is bent at a right angle, 90 degrees, and hold the upper arm away from the patient's body. 2. Gently slap the insides of the biceps with your fingers halfway between the shoulder and the elbow to push the biceps out of the way. 3. Slide your fingers up to push the biceps away. 4. Squeeze, press your hand down on the humerus, upper arm bone. You should be able to feel the pulse as you press down. If the patient is sitting down, squeeze the arm by placing your fingers halfway between the shoulder and the elbow and your thumb on the opposite side of the patient's arm. If done properly, this technique, in combination with direct wound pressure and elevation, will quickly stop any bleeding below the point of pressure application. The femoral artery pressure point is more difficult to locate and squeeze. Follow these steps to apply pressure to the femoral artery. 1. Position the patient on his or her back and kneel next to the patient's hips, facing the patient's head. You should be on the side of the patient opposite the extremity that is bleeding. 2. Find the pelvis and place the little finger of your hand closest to the injured leg along the anterior crest on the injured side. 3. Rotate your hand down firmly into the groin area between the genitals and the pelvic bone. This action compresses the femoral artery and usually stops the bleeding when combined with elevation and direct pressure over the bleeding site. 4. If the bleeding does not slow immediately, reposition your hand and try again. To effectively apply brachial and femoral pressure points, you must regularly practice each step of these skills. Standard precautions and bleeding control. Certain communicable diseases, such as hepatitis or HIV, can be spread by contact with blood from an infected person. This risk is greatly increased when the infected blood comes into contact with a cut or an open sore on your skin. Although your risk of contracting hepatitis or HIV through intact skin is small, you should minimize this risk as much as possible by wearing nitrile or latex gloves whenever you come in contact with a patient's blood or body fluids. Carry your gloves on top of your EMR life support kit or in a pouch on your belt for quick access. If you do get blood on your hands, wash it off as soon as possible with soap and water. If you are in the field and cannot wash your hands, use a waterless hand cleaning solution that contains an effective germ-killing agent. Wounds. A wound is an injury caused by any physical means that leads to damage of a body part. Wounds are classified as closed or open. In a closed wound, the skin remains intact. In an open wound, the skin is disrupted. Closed wounds. The only closed wound is the bruise, contusion. A bruise is an injury of the soft tissue beneath the skin. Because small blood vessels are broken, the injured area becomes discolored and swells. The severity of these closed soft tissue injuries varies greatly. A simple bruise heals quickly. In contrast, bruising and swelling following an injury may also be a sign of an underlying fracture. Whenever you encounter a significant amount of swelling or bruising, suspect the possibility of an underlying fracture. Open wounds. An open wound is one that results in a break in the skin. There are several types of open wounds, including abrasions, puncture wounds, lacerations, avulsions, and amputations. Each type is described below. Abrasion. Commonly called a scrape, road rash, or rug burn, an abrasion occurs when the skin is rubbed across a rough surface. Puncture. Puncture wounds are caused by a sharp object that penetrates the skin. These wounds may cause a significant deep injury that is not immediately recognized. Puncture wounds do not bleed freely. If the object that caused the puncture wound remains sticking out of the skin, it is called an impaled object. A gunshot wound is a special type of puncture wound. The amount of damage done by a gunshot depends on the type of gun used and the distance between the gun and the victim. A gunshot entry wound may appear as an insignificant hole, but the bullet can cause massive damage to internal organs. Some gunshot wounds are smaller than a dime, and some are large enough to destroy significant amounts of tissue. Gunshot wounds usually have both an entrance wound and an exit wound. The entrance wound is usually smaller than the exit wound. Most deaths from gunshot wounds result from internal blood loss caused by damage to internal organs and major blood vessels as the bullet passes through the body. There is often more than one gunshot wound. It is important to conduct a thorough patient exam to ensure that you have discovered all of the entrance and exit wounds. Laceration. The most common type of open wound is a laceration. Lacerations are commonly called cuts. Minor lacerations may require little care, but large lacerations can cause extensive bleeding and can even be life-threatening. Avulsions and amputations. An avulsion is a tearing away of body tissue. The avulsed part may be totally severed from the body, or it may be attached by a flap of skin. Avulsions may involve small or large amounts of tissue. If an entire body part is torn away, the wound is called a traumatic amputation. Any amputated body part should be located, placed in a clean plastic bag, kept cool, and taken with the patient to the hospital for possible reattachment, reimplantation. If the amputated part is small and a clean plastic bag is not available, use a surgical glove turned inside out. Use cold packs or ice water to keep the detached body parts cold. Do not allow ice to touch the body part directly. Principles of wound treatment. Very minor bruises need no treatment. Other closed wounds should be treated by applying ice and gentle compression and by elevating the injured body part. Because extensive bruising may indicate an underlying fracture, splint all major contusions. Splinting involves using flexible or rigid support to prevent the movement of the injured body part. Splinting is discussed more detail in Chapter 15, Injuries to Muscles and Bones. It is important to stop bleeding as quickly as possible using the cleanest dressing available. You can usually control bleeding by covering an open wound with a dry, clean, or sterile dressing and applying pressure to the dressing with your hand. If the first dressing does not control the bleeding, reinforce it with a second layer. Additional ways to control bleeding include elevating an extremity, applying a tourniquet, and using pressure points. A dressing should cover the entire wound to prevent further contamination. Do not attempt to clean the contaminated wound in the field because cleaning will only cause more bleeding. A thorough cleaning will be done at the hospital. All dressings should be secured in place by a compression bandage. Learning to dress and bandage wounds requires practice. As a trained EMR, you should be able to bandage all parts of the body quickly and competently. Dressing and bandaging wounds. All wounds require bandaging. Therefore, you should be familiar with the general principles of applying dressings and bandages to effectively cover and protect wounds. Dressings and bandages are applied to achieve the following: control bleeding, prevent further contamination, prevent movement of impaled objects. Dressings. A dressing is an object placed directly on a wound to control bleeding and prevent further contamination. Once a dressing is in place, apply firm, direct manual pressure on it to stop any bleeding. It is important to stop severe bleeding as quickly as possible using the cleanest dressing available. If no dressing materials are available, you may have to apply direct pressure with your hand to a wound that is bleeding extensively. If this is the case, be sure to observe standard precautions and wear gloves. Sterile dressings come packaged in many different sizes. The three most common sizes are gauze squares that measure 4 inches by 4 inches, 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters, commonly known as 4x4s, heavier pads that measure 5 inches by 9 inches, 13 centimeters by 23 centimeters, 5x9s, and trauma dressings that are thick, sterile dressings that measure 10 inches by 30 inches, 25 centimeters by 76 centimeters. Use a trauma dressing to cover a large wound on the abdomen, neck, thigh, or scalp, or as padding for splints. When you open a package containing a sterile dressing, touch only one corner of the dressing. Place it on the wound without touching the side of the dressing that will be next to the wound. If bleeding continues after you have applied a compression dressing to the wound, put additional gauze pads over the original dressing. Do not remove the original dressing because the blood clotting process will have already started and should not be disrupted. When you are satisfied that the wound is sufficiently dressed, you can proceed to bandaging the wound. Bandaging. A bandage is used to hold the dressing in place. Two types of bandages commonly used in the field are roller gauze and triangular bandages. The first type, conforming roller gauze, stretches slightly and is easy to wrap around the body part. Triangular bandages are usually 36 inches, 91 centimeters across. A triangular bandage can be folded and used as a wide cravat, or it can be used without folding. Roller gauze is easier to apply and stays in place better than a triangular bandage, but a triangular bandage is very useful for bandaging scalp lacerations and lacerations of the chest, abdomen, back, or thigh. Follow certain principles if the bandage is to hold the dressing in place, control bleeding, and prevent further contamination. Before you apply a bandage, check to ensure the dressing covers the wound completely and extends beyond all sides of the wound. Wrap the bandage just tightly enough to control bleeding. Do not apply it too tightly because it may cut off all circulation. It is important to regularly check circulation at a point farther away from the heart than the injury itself because swelling may make the bandage too tight. If this happens while the patient is under your care, remove the roller gauze or triangular bandage and reapply it, making sure that you do not disturb the dressing beneath. Once you have completed applying the bandage, secure it so it cannot slip. Tape, tie, or tuck in any loose ends. Practice bandaging techniques for several types of wounds using both roller gauze and triangular bandages. Although the principles of bandaging are simple, some parts of the body are difficult to bandage. It is important to practice bandaging different parts of the body to ensure competency in emergency medical care situations. Standard precaution techniques for the EMR. Some infectious disease organisms, including the hepatitis and AIDS viruses, can be transmitted if blood from an infected person enters the bloodstream of a healthy person through a small cut or opening in the skin. Because you may have such a cut, it is important to wear gloves to avoid contact with patient's blood. Wearing gloves also protects wounds from being contaminated by dirt or infectious organisms you may have on your hands. Nitrile or latex medical gloves can be stored on the top of your EMR life support kit or in a pouch on your belt, where they will be readily available. See Chapter 2, Workforce Safety and Wellness, for more information on infectious diseases. Specific wound treatment. The preceding material discussed the general principles of wound treatment. The next section discusses treatment for specific types of wounds on different parts of the body. Face and scalp wounds. The face and scalp have many blood vessels. Because of this generous blood supply, a relatively small laceration can result in significant bleeding. Although face and scalp lacerations may not be life-threatening, they are always bloody and cause much anxiety for the patient. You can control almost all facial or scalp bleeding by applying direct manual pressure. Direct pressure is effective because the bones of the skull are so close to the skin. Direct pressure compresses the blood vessels against the skull and stops the bleeding. If bleeding continues, do not remove the dressing. Instead, reinforce it with a second layer and continue to apply manual pressure. After the bleeding stops, wrap the head with a bandage. For wounds inside the cheek, hold a gauze pad inside the cheek, in the mouth. If necessary, apply a pad outside the cheek. Always keep the airway open. Severe scalp lacerations may be associated with skull fractures or even brain injury. If any brain tissue or bone fragments are visible, do not apply pressure to the wound. Instead, cover the wound loosely, being careful not to exert direct pressure on the brain or the bone fragments. If the patient has a head injury, the neck and spine may also be injured. Move the head as little as possible and stabilize the neck. Treatment of spinal injuries is discussed in Chapter 15, Injuries to Muscles and Bones. In patients with a head injury, always evaluate the patient's level of consciousness. Carefully monitor the patient's airway and breathing and protect the spine. Nosebleeds. Nosebleeds can result from injury, high blood pressure, or dry air. In some cases, there is no apparent cause. A nosebleed with no apparent cause is called a spontaneous nosebleed. In a patient with high blood pressure, increased pressure in the small blood vessels of the nose may cause one to rupture, resulting in bleeding. A patient with high blood pressure should be seen and treated by a physician. Most nosebleeds can be controlled easily unless the patient is experiencing shock. Have the patient sit down and tilt his or her head slightly forward. This position keeps the blood from dripping down the throat. Swallowing blood may cause coughing or vomiting and make the nose bleed worse. After the patient is seated correctly, pinch both nostrils together for at least 5 minutes. The patient may wish to do this without assistance. This treatment usually controls nosebleeds. If the nosebleed persists or is very severe, arrange for transport to an appropriate medical facility. Instruct the patient to avoid blowing his or her nose because this will often cause additional bleeding. Eye injuries. All eye injuries are potentially serious and require medical evaluation. When an eye laceration is suspected, cover the entire eye with a dry gauze pad. Have the patient lie on his or her back and arrange for transport to an appropriate medical facility. If a small foreign object is lying on the surface of the patient's eye, you can use a saline solution, when available, to gently flush the object from the eye. Clean water can also be used, but it tends to irritate the injured eye. Flush from the nose side toward the outside to avoid flushing the object into the other eye. Even small foreign objects can leave a small scratch on the surface of the eye. It is always a good idea to transport the patient to an appropriate medical facility for further assessment and possible treatment. Occasionally, an object will be impaled in the eye. Immediately place the patient on his or her back and cover the injured eye with a dressing and a paper cup so the impaled object cannot move. Remember to bandage both eyes. This is an important step to help minimize eye movement because if the patient attempts to look at something with the uninjured eye, the injured eye moves in conjunction, further aggravating the injury. Arrange for transport of the patient to the hospital. Neck wounds. The neck contains many important structures: the trachea, the esophagus, large arteries, veins, muscles, vertebrae, and the spinal cord. Because an injury to any of these structures may be life-threatening, all neck injuries are considered serious. Apply direct pressure to control bleeding neck wounds. Once bleeding is controlled, dress the neck. In rare cases, you may have to exert finger pressure above and below the injury site to prevent further neck bleeding. Always keep in mind that major trauma to the neck may be associated with airway problems and with neck fracture or spinal cord injury. Therefore, maintain the patient's airway and stabilize the head and neck. Chest and back wounds. The major organs affected by chest wounds and back wounds are the lungs, large blood vessels, and heart. Any wound involving these organs is a life-threatening injury. Place the patient with a chest injury in a comfortable position, usually sitting. See Chapter 15, Injuries to Muscles and Bones. If a lung is punctured, air can escape and the lung can collapse. The patient may cough up bright red blood. To help maintain air pressure in the lung, your first action should be to cover any open chest wound with an airtight material, thereby sealing the wound. This covering is called an occlusive dressing. Use a clear plastic cover from your medical supplies, aluminum foil, plastic wrap, gloves, or a special dressing that has been impregnated with petroleum jelly, Vaseline. Any material that will occlude, seal off the wound is sufficient. Administering oxygen is important early treatment for a patient with an injured lung. It should be given by EMS personnel when they arrive or by EMRs who are trained and have the equipment available. Chest wounds may also damage the heart. Seal the wound in the manner described and monitor the patient's airway, breathing, and circulation. Treat the patient for shock and perform CPR if necessary. If the patient's breathing becomes more labored after you seal the chest wound, you may need to remove the seal briefly to allow excess air to escape and then reseal the wound. Impaled objects. If an object is impaled in the patient, apply a stabilizing dressing and arrange for the patient's prompt transport to an appropriate medical facility. Sometimes, an impaled object is too long to permit the patient to be removed from the scene and transported to an appropriate medical facility. In these situations, it may be necessary to stabilize the impaled object and carefully cut it close to the patient's body. If you encounter a situation like this, stabilize the impaled object as well as you can and immediately request a specialized rescue team that has the tools and training to handle this type of incident. If your patient has a knife or other object protruding from the abdomen, do not attempt to remove it. Instead, support the impaled object so it cannot move. Place a large roll of gauze or towels on either side of the object and secure the rolls with additional gauze wrapped around the patient's body. It is important to stabilize the object so it will not move while the patient is being transported to the hospital. Any movement of the object may cause further internal damage. Closed abdominal wounds. Closed abdominal wounds commonly occur as the result of a direct blow from a blunt object. Check for a closed abdominal wound whenever force has been applied to the abdomen. Look for bruises or other marks on the abdomen that indicate blunt injury. Anytime an injured patient is experiencing shock, you should remember that there may be internal abdominal injuries accompanied by bleeding. When there is internal bleeding, the abdomen may become swollen, rigid, or hard like a board. Treat patients with closed abdominal injuries and signs of shock by placing them on their backs, unless they have difficulty breathing. Use blankets to help conserve their body heat and elevate the legs if indicated by local protocol. If the patient is vomiting blood, ranging in color from bright red to dark brown, it may be an indication of bleeding from the esophagus or stomach. Monitor the patient's airway and vital signs carefully because shock may result. Give the patient nothing by mouth. Arrange for prompt transport to an appropriate medical facility. Open abdominal wounds. Open abdominal wounds usually result from slashing with a knife or other sharp object and are always serious injuries. If the intestines are protruding from the abdomen, an evisceration, place the patient on his or her back with the knees bent to relax the abdominal muscles. Cover the injured area with a sterile dressing. Do not attempt to replace the intestines inside the abdomen. You can make a bandage from a large trauma pad, 10 inches by 30 inches, 25 centimeters by 76 centimeters, and several cravats to cover protruding abdominal intestines. Position the trauma pad to cover the whole area of the wound. Tie two or three wide cravats loosely over the trauma pad, just tightly enough to keep it firmly in place, but not tightly enough to push the intestines back into the abdomen. EMTs and paramedics carry sterile saline, salt water, that can be poured on the dressing to keep the protruding organs moist so they do not dry out. Use only sterile saline. Genital wounds. Both male and female genitals have a rich blood supply. Injury to the genitals often results in severe bleeding. Apply direct pressure to any genital wound with a dry, sterile dressing. Direct pressure usually stops the bleeding. Although it may be embarrassing to examine the patient's genital area to determine the severity of the injury, you must do so if you suspect such injuries. The patient can experience a critical loss of blood if you do not find the injury and control the bleeding. Extremity wounds. To treat all open extremity wounds, apply a dry, sterile compression dressing and bandage it securely in place. Elevate the injured part to help decrease bleeding and swelling. Splint all injured extremities prior to transport because there may be an underlying fracture. Gunshot wounds. Some gunshot wounds are easy to miss unless you perform a thorough patient examination. Most deaths from gunshot wounds result from internal blood loss caused by damage to internal organs and major blood vessels. Because gunshot wounds are so serious, prompt and effective treatment is important. Gunshot wounds of the trunk and neck can cause spinal cord injuries. Because you cannot see the bullet's path through the body, you should treat these patients for spinal cord injuries. To treat a patient with a gunshot wound, follow these steps. 1. Open the airway and establish adequate ventilation and circulation. 2. Control any external bleeding by covering wounds with sterile dressings and applying pressure with your hand or a bandage. 3. Examine the patient thoroughly to ensure you have discovered all entrance and exit wounds. 4. Treat for symptoms of shock by performing the following actions. Maintain the patient's body temperature. Place the patient on his or her back and elevate the legs if indicated by local protocol. Place a patient who is having difficulty breathing in a semi-reclining position. Administer oxygen if available. 5. Arrange for prompt transport of the patient to an appropriate medical facility. 6. Perform CPR if the patient's heart stops as a result of loss of blood. Bites. Bites from animals or humans may range from minor to severe. All bites carry a high risk of causing infection. Bites from an unvaccinated or wild animal may cause rabies. Minor bites can be washed with soap and water if they are available. Major bite wounds should be treated by controlling the bleeding and applying a suitable dressing and bandage. All patients who have been bitten by an animal or another person must be treated by a physician. In most states, EMS or hospital personnel are required to report animal bites to the local health department or a law enforcement agency. Check the laws in your local area to determine requirements. Burns. The skin serves as a barrier that prevents foreign substances, such as bacteria, from entering the body. It also prevents the loss of body fluids. When the skin is damaged, such as by a burn, it can no longer perform these essential functions. Burn depth. There are three classifications of burns by depth: superficial, first-degree burns; partial thickness, second-degree burns; and full thickness, third-degree burns. Although it is not always possible to determine the exact degree of a burn injury, it is important to understand this concept. Superficial burns, first-degree burns, are characterized by reddened and painful skin. The injury is confined to the outermost layers of skin, and the patient experiences minor to moderate pain. An example of a superficial burn is sunburn, which usually heals in about a week with or without treatment. Partial thickness burns, second-degree burns, are somewhat deeper but do not damage the deepest layers of the skin. Blistering is present, although blisters may not form for several hours in some cases. There may be some fluid loss and moderate to severe pain because the nerve endings are damaged. Partial thickness burns require medical treatment. They usually heal within 2 to 3 weeks. Full thickness burns, third-degree burns, damage all layers of the skin. In some cases, the damage is deep enough to injure and destroy underlying muscles and other tissues. Pain is often absent because the nerve endings have been destroyed. Without the protection provided by the skin, patients with extensive full-thickness burns lose large quantities of body fluids and are susceptible to shock and infection. If the patient has injuries in addition to the burn, treat the injuries before transporting the patient. For example, if a patient who has a partial thickness burn of the arm has also fallen off a ladder and fractured both legs, splint the fractures and place the patient on a backboard in addition to treating the burn injury. Extent of burns. The rule of nines is a method used to determine what percentage of the body has been burned. Although this rule is most useful for EMTs and paramedics who report information to the hospital from the field, you should be able to roughly estimate the extent of a burn. The rule of nines divides the body. In an adult, the head and arms each equal 9% of the total body surface. The front and back of the trunk and each leg are equal to 18% of the total body surface. For example, if one half of the back and the entire right arm of a patient are burned, the burn involves about 18% of the total body area. The rule of nines is slightly modified for young children, but the adult percentages serve as an adequate guide. Cause or type of burns. Burns are an injury to body cells caused by excess exposure to heat, thermal burns, chemicals, or electricity. They may involve a small area of the body or involve the entire body. Burns can cause minor injuries affecting only the top layers of the skin, or they can be deep, involving muscles, blood vessels, and nerves. Severe burns can involve damage to all the organs and systems of the body. This section discusses the three major causes of burns: heat, chemicals, and electricity. It discusses the impact, the size, and severity of the burn have on the patient, as well as the care and treatment you can provide to a burn patient. Thermal burns. Thermal burns are caused by heat. The first step in treating thermal burns is to cool the skin by putting out the fire. Superficial burns can be quite painful, but if there is clean, cold water available, you can place the burned area in cold water to help reduce the pain. You can also wet a clean towel with cold water and put it on superficial burns. After the burned area is cooled, cover it with a dry, sterile dressing or a large sterile cloth called a burn sheet, found in your EMR life support kit. Partial thickness burns should be cooled if the burn area is still warm. Cooling helps reduce pain, stops the heat from further injuring the skin, and helps stop the swelling caused by partial thickness burns. If blisters are present, be very careful not to break the blisters. Intact skin, even if blistered, provides an excellent barrier against infection. If the blisters break, the danger of infection increases. Cover partial thickness burns with a dry, sterile dressing or burn sheet. Full thickness burns, if still warm, should also be cooled with water to keep the heat from damaging more skin and tissue. Cut any clothing away from the burned area, but leave any clothing that is stuck to the burn. Cover full thickness burns with a dry, sterile dressing or burn sheet. Patients with large superficial burns or any partial thickness or full thickness burns must be treated for shock and transported to a hospital. Respiratory burns. A burn to any part of the airway is a respiratory burn. If a patient has been burned around the head and face or while in a confined space, such as in a burning house, Look for the signs and symptoms of respiratory burns listed in the signs and symptoms box. Watch the patient carefully. Breathing problems that result from this type of burn can develop rapidly or slowly over several hours. Administer oxygen as soon as it is available and be prepared to perform CPR. If you suspect that a patient has sustained respiratory burns, arrange for prompt transport to a medical facility. Chemical burns. Many strong substances can cause chemical burns to the skin, and chemicals are extremely dangerous to the eyes. These substances include strong acids such as battery acid or strong alkalis such as drain cleaners. Some chemicals are so strong or caustic that they can cause damage to the skin or eyes even if the exposure is very brief. The longer the chemical remains in contact with the skin, the more it damages the skin and underlying tissues, oftentimes resulting in superficial, partial thickness, or full thickness burns to the skin. The initial treatment for chemical burns is to remove as much of the chemical as possible from the patient's skin. Brush away any dry chemical on the patient's clothes or skin, being careful not to get any on yourself. You may have to ask the patient to remove all clothing. After you have removed as much of the dry chemical as possible, flush the contaminated skin with abundant quantities of water. Use water from a garden hose, a shower in the home or factory, or even the booster hose of a fire engine. It is essential that the chemical be washed off the skin quickly to avoid further injury. Flush the affected area of the body for at least 10 minutes, then cover the burned area with a dry, sterile dressing or a burn sheet and arrange for prompt transport to an appropriate medical facility. Chemical burns to the eyes cause extreme pain and severe injury. Gently flush the affected eye or eyes with water for at least 20 minutes. Hold the eye open to allow water to flow over its entire surface. Direct the water from the inner corner of the eye to the outward edge of the eye to avoid contaminating the unaffected eye. You may have to put the patient's face under a shower, garden hose, or faucet so the water flows across the patient's entire face. Continue flushing the eyes while the patient is being transported. After flushing the eyes for 20 minutes, loosely cover the injured eye or eyes with gauze bandages and arrange for prompt transport to an appropriate medical facility. All chemical burns should be examined by a physician. Electrical burns. Electrical burns can cause severe injuries or even death, but they leave little evidence of injury on the outside of the body. These burns are caused by an electrical current that enters the body at one point, for example, the hand that touches the live electrical wire, travels through the body tissues and organs, and exits from the body at the point of ground contact. Electricity causes major internal damage rather than external damage. A strong electrical current can actually cook muscles, nerves, blood vessels, and internal organs, resulting in major damage. Patients who have been subjected to a strong electrical current can also experience irregularities of cardiac rhythm or even full cardiac arrest and death. Children often sustain electrical burns by chewing on an electrical cord or pushing something into an outlet. Although the burn may not look serious at first, it is often quite severe because of underlying tissue injury. Persons who have been hit or nearly hit by lightning frequently sustain electrical burns. Treat these patients as you would electrical burn patients. Evaluate them carefully because they may also experience cardiac arrest. Arrange for prompt transport to an appropriate medical facility. Before you touch or treat a person who has sustained an electrical burn, be certain the patient is still not in contact with the electrical power source that caused the burn. If the patient is still in contact with the power source, anyone who touches him or her may be electrocuted. If the patient is touching a live power source, your first act must be to unplug, disconnect, or turn off the power. If you cannot do this alone, call for assistance from the power company or from a qualified rescue squad or fire department. If a power line falls on top of a motor vehicle, the people inside the vehicle must be told to stay inside until qualified personnel can remove the power line or turn the power off. After ensuring that the power has been disconnected, examine each electrical burn patient carefully, assess the ABCs, and treat the patient for visible external burns. Cover these external burns with a dry, sterile dressing and arrange for prompt transport to an appropriate medical facility. Monitor the airway, breathing, and circulation of electrical burn patients closely and arrange to have these patients transported promptly to an appropriate medical facility for further treatment. Multisystem trauma. Multisystem trauma is an injury that affects more than one body system. The injuries in multisystem trauma can occur in one part of the body, but involve different body systems. For example, an unrestrained patient who hits the steering wheel in a motor vehicle crash can sustain trauma to the chest. This trauma could result in injuries to both the heart, the circulatory system, and to the lungs, the respiratory system. Another patient in a vehicle crash might have injuries to different parts of the body, for example, to the abdomen and to the head. Both of these patients have sustained multi-system trauma. As an EMR, you are not expected to diagnose a patient's injuries. However, it is important to remember that several body systems may be injured in situations that involve significant trauma. As you assess your patients, be alert for signs and symptoms of injury to each part of the body.